I'm a volunteer with the University of Wisconsin Oral History Project. It is April 28th, 2004, and I'm here with Dr. Enid Gilbert Barnes. We're in the home of Dr. William Seeger because Dr. Gilbert Barnes lives in Florida, and she's up here for a lecture series. And Enid, we'd like very much to have you sort of start with your beginnings in Australia.
Well, I was born in Sydney, Australia. I can give you the dates that will divulge my age. As I've always said, you're as old as you feel. And my children like to think I'm 59 and holding. But I'm 76 years of age. I was born in Sydney, as I mentioned, in 1927. I went to grade school and high school in Sydney, and I went to medical school at the University of Sydney in Australia. And following that, I did an internship, a rotating internship, in one of the teaching hospitals in Sydney. And following that, I went to England and spent a year in England where I did internal medicine and pediatrics.
Now, let's back up just a little bit. You had a family? Did you have brothers and sisters?
Oh, yes, I had.
Tell us a little about your parents.
My parents, my father was on the faculty of the University of Sydney in the chemistry department. He was a founding member of the Australian Aero Club and actually flew with Sir Kingsford Smith. And the airport, he was a famous aviator in his day, and the airport in Sydney is called the Kingsford Smith Airport. But he later left the university and became a builder, an architect. He was quite a well-known architect of his day. And when I first went to the university, he was still on the faculty. And I have a sister who only recently died. She was 4 years older than I, and she graduated from Sydney University as well in science and became a science teacher, married and had 4 children. I left the country after my year of internship, but have gone back frequently, particularly when my mother was still alive. I used to go back at least once every year to see her.
Does everyone go to England for a year?
Well, in my day, and that is now, I graduated in 1950. Mm-hmm. And in those days, England was the place that most people went for mm-hmm. postgraduate training. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't unusual for graduates, particularly of Sydney University, to go to England and spend time in postgraduate training.
So you were a resident in pediatrics?
When I went to England.
When you went to England?
I was a senior, well, they call them registrars in England, but it's the same as being a senior resident. Mm-hmm. And I did 6 months in internal medicine and 6 months in pediatrics. And then I, from England, I came to Boston, to the Children's Hospital in Boston, and did a pediatric residency there.
That was a big step.
It was. Well, I had been engaged to a boy who contracted bulbar polio, and he died. And it was before the vaccinations were available. And So I had an introduction to come to the Children's Hospital in Boston by the professor of pediatrics in Sydney, at Sydney University, who was a good friend of the Harvard professor of pediatrics. So it was sort of arranged that way, but I think I was very fortunate in being able to do my residency in probably the greatest pediatric and children's hospital in the world. And I was there at a time when exchange transfusions were just beginning for the Rh factor, if you know what that is.
Yes, I do.
And it was the only place in the world where they were doing that. And we had babies flown in from all over the world, and we were doing the exchange transfusions there. I was at a time at Boston Children's Hospital where so much development was going on and so many great discoveries, and I was fortunate enough to be there right on the spot and to work with these really very famous people who had contributed so much. But after that, I had been offered, I had a position at the Children's Hospital in Sydney, and I didn't know whether what I wanted to do with my life. I had lost my fiancé, and the professor of pediatrics at Harvard, Dr. Charles Janeway, and Sidney Gellis, who was another very famous pediatrician, both told me that I should not go back to Australia until I'd spent at least a year with Lou Barnes, whom I much later did marry, but he had been at Harvard and had been on the faculty there and had accepted a position at the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, the University of Pennsylvania. So they called him on the phone and they asked him, would he take me? He had no money. It was right at the end of the year. It was the end of June. He had no money and he had no positions. But he said he didn't have the heart to turn those two people down who had been his mentors and who had meant so much in his career. So he took me sight unseen.
Now, what was so special? I mean, obviously you married him, so he was special, but what was so special about his, that you needed to have his training?
Well, he was very well known, even though he was young at that time. And he has been named the Master of Pediatrics.
Mm-hmm.
He's much more famous than I could ever be. But I had known him from his reputation, and I think it was a special occasion, or a special opportunity for me to work with him.
Mm-hmm.
That time, I thought, just for a year. He had me do research with him, and he wanted somebody to collect specimens from a foundling home in Philadelphia where there were unwed women. In those days, of course, it's closed now, but this is 50 years ago. And he needed someone, he was doing nitrogen balance studies, and he wanted someone to go to this foundling home at a weekend and collect the urine and feces, which I thought was scut work, but he was such a great person, and we all adored him. He was not married at the time, and I volunteered. So I used to go out on the streetcar and collect these specimens for him. And I always tease him about him getting me to do all his scut work.
Was this from the mothers or from the babies?
No, from the babies.
From the babies.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it happened that it was right opposite a church, an Episcopal church, where I would go on a Sunday morning. And then I'd go over and collect the specimens for it. So that was my experience in Philadelphia. I actually married, my first marriage was the son of the Episcopal minister where I attended the church. He was also a doctor and worked at NIH.
Mm-hmm.
And it was many years later that I re-met Lou, when I was invited many years later then to go to Florida to teach, just as a visiting professor. And I learnt that he was chairman of pediatrics there. And that was how I reunited with Lou Barnes.
That's a nice story.
So it's interesting.
You went into pathology at right. some point also.
Right. After I finished in Philadelphia, we lived on the grounds of NIH in Washington. And I, at that time, wanted to do cardiology. I really wanted to be a pediatric cardiologist. But I was not a citizen. And in those days, it required citizenship to be able to obtain a fellowship. So there was available a position or a residency or fellowship training in pathology, pediatric pathology. So since that was available, I took it somewhat reluctantly because I never really thought I'd want to be a pathologist. But it turned out that I really love pathology. I really have no regrets that I ultimately became a pathologist. So from that point on, I took the whole pathology residency training program and ended up, by default, more than anything else, a pediatric pathologist, because I had done pediatrics and I'd done 2 years in pediatric pathology at Washington Children's Hospital.
Now, you did this pathology residency in Austin, Texas.
I did 2 years in at Washington Children's Hospital in pathology, pediatric pathology. Mm-hmm. Then my husband accepted a job at the University of Texas. So I completed my pathology training in Texas. That was general pathology.
Mm-hmm.
And then took my boards and became certified pathologist. But pediatric pathology has always been my first love and what I really concentrated my career on.
It's hard for me to put all these pieces together because you've
right.
been keeping seven balls in the air for so many years
right.
that it's difficult to sort of get a trend here. But you obviously stayed with pediatrics.
Oh yes, I've always stayed with pediatrics, but then did pathology, 2 years in pathology
mm-hmm.
in pediatrics,
mm-hmm.
and then decided that if I really wanted to practice pediatric pathology, I'd have to complete a residency, which was 4 years. In those days it's now 5 years, but I took the extra 2 years in adult pathology.
Mm-hmm.
But have always maintained my interest and most of my activity in pediatric pathology, which wasn't very well known in those days. There were just a handful of people in the country. In fact, I think I was the first person in the country to be trained as a pediatrician and have my boards in pediatrics, and then to do pathology and have boards in pathology as well. Now there are several others, but I believe I was the first person to do that.
So how did you happen to come to Wisconsin?
Well, that was in 1970.
In the meantime, you'd been in West Virginia.
West Virginia, right. We went from Texas to West Virginia. I worked in West Virginia. I might add that I've had children during these years, and after I started having a family, I took a year off when my first child was born, because at that time I thought that my role was to be a mother and take care of my family, and perhaps even give up medicine. But by the end of a year, I started having itchy feet. I felt that I really did want to put in some time. in a profession that I'd spent so many years in training. So I went back half-time, and I only worked half-time until my children were all in school, or started school. And my youngest started at a Montessori school when she was 3 years of age. So I had five children, and I spent over 10 years, I guess it was, in just working part-time.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly don't regret that. In fact, I still wonder whether I put in enough time with my children.
We all wonder that.
Okay, I guess we do.
So then you came from West Virginia. How was it in West Virginia?
Well, it's sort of part of Appalachia. It's mm-hmm. A little backward. I didn't think the medical school was that great. But it was a fairly new medical school.
Mm-hmm.
So I did what I enjoyed doing, and that was fine.
Mm-hmm.
I got the teaching award there the year I left, which pleased me no end. I've always enjoyed teaching. And then we came to Wisconsin. I was actually looking for a job because my husband had taken a fellowship in molecular biology. And I didn't have anything to do here. So I literally begged the people here in pathology to take me and give me some sort of job. And I remember very clearly that the head of pathology at the VA wanted me to go there. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is the end of the world. I don't want to do, you know, pathology on old crocs that were at the VA. And here I was, a pediatric pathologist. So Henry Pito was the chairman at the time, and he was very, very gracious. And he said he'd be delighted to have me come first as a visiting professor. And after I'd been here just about a month, I think it was in August, they had a meeting of the department, and Henry Pito was chairman. I don't know whether you remember Henry.
Yes, Pito. I do.
And he had a meeting to propose that I be made a full faculty member and given a full professorship with tenure. Well, the day that this meeting was held, I knew that there was going to be a faculty meeting, but I hadn't been invited, but I thought I should go. I thought everyone went to a faculty meeting. So I sallied forth and went into the meeting, and everyone looked very nervous and uncomfortable. And finally, Henry looked at me and he said, "Enid, I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to leave." Well, I left, but I was in tears. I thought, well, this is the end. He's going to fire me. I'm not going to have a job. So immediately after that, he came up to my room, and here I was sobbing in my desk.
Oh,
and he put his arm around me, and he said, well, he had very good news for me, that they had recommended that I be a tenured full professor in the department.
So that was quite a promotion.
Well, it was. Out of the blue.
My goodness. Excuse me.
But I must say that my years in Wisconsin were the most fruitful and the very best years of my life and my career. I was at the University of Wisconsin for almost 23 years. And I had every opportunity and worked with the really very best people. And particularly Dr. John Opitz. I don't know whether you remember him, but he was in genetics.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so delighted to have someone in pediatric pathology that may have an interest in genetics. I didn't have any specific interest at that time, but I certainly developed it. And under his guidance, I have done a lot of work in particularly genetic pathology.
Well, I've noticed that as I have gone through here. You had such a varied had such varied interests. I suppose pathology leads you into infant death syndrome.
Right, well, pathology is very encompassing, I think, particularly pediatric pathology. And I had the opportunity while I was here to develop strong interest in genetic pathology with Dr. John Opitz. And I think many of my publications and work that I did here was with Dr. Opitz, as you might see from the publications. And of course, sudden infant death has always been an interest of mine from when I even started pediatrics. It was such a mystery, and nobody really understood why these babies died and how they died. And so that has been a very strong interest of mine.
Are you still doing
some research in that area. We found, while I was working here at the University of Wisconsin, that many of these babies had very high fetal hemoglobin. Fetal hemoglobin is the hemoglobin that is present in the fetus. And under conditions of hypoxemia or low oxygen tension in the infant, that fetal hemoglobin may persist for a longer period of time. It ordinarily disappears within the first few weeks of life. But we found that between 80 and 90% of babies who died from what was called sudden infant death syndrome actually had very high fetal hemoglobins. So we were able to define what I and many others now have accepted, the really underlying cause for sudden infant death syndrome, that these babies suffer from hypoxemia, lack of oxygen, well before they were born. And this becomes manifested at a time when normal physiological anemia occurs in a baby, so that it's sort of an added insult, and they may die during this 2 to 4 month period where most of them do die. And we published that paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, and now other studies have confirmed our original findings, and we're continuing to do this work with the fetal hemoglobin. And I think the whole issue now of sudden infant death syndrome has been largely eliminated by changing the position, the sleeping position, which I'm sure you've heard about, the so-called back to sleep campaign. Well, I was aware that babies who slept on their back had a very low incidence of sudden infant death. And we visited China, it was 3 times now, and we'd see all these babies in nurseries lying on their backs. And they swore that they never saw sudden infant death syndrome that we were talking about in the United States. So that made me realize that there was something going on there. And then when we looked at, my husband also was interested in this, certainly through my interest, and it was found that in Australia, where they many babies were sleeping on their backs, and in New Zealand and in England, they had reduced the incidence of SIDS very drastically. So I wrote a position paper for the American Academy of Pediatrics to the Accident Prevention Committee, requesting that they adopt or endorse the Back to Sleep program, which is how it all evolved. And now, of course, it's accepted, and all babies now are, or mothers are advised to put their babies to sleep on their back. So this was sort of originated the Back to Sleep campaign in this country.
I think
that has eliminated about 75% of sudden infant deaths. Deaths.
Interesting. So when my grandchildren first started being born, they were put to bed as the Australian children were, on a sheepskin.
Right. Well, that is very dangerous. That is another thing that I was able to do some years ago. Also, while everything happened in my career when I was at the University of Wisconsin. I was referred almost all the sudden infant deaths in the state while I was here. And we had, I think, 4 babies that died who happened to have been sleeping on a waterbed. And after the 4th one, I thought, well, there must be something in this. This is before the back to sleep program was initiated. And got the loan of a medical student's baby who was about 3 months of age. And he was there, and we didn't let this baby suffer, but we put the baby on a waterbed. And we noticed that the baby sank, and the head sank, and the baby would stretch its arms out in an aeroplane type maneuver, trying to extricate its head out of this sinkhole. And I was convinced then that there was something, that these babies were actually asphyxiating, smothering. And then I notified the U.S. Consumer Safety Commission in Washington, and they investigated, or they had been referred all their sudden infant death syndrome cases around the country, and they sifted out many that had died on a waterbed. So the attorney for the U.S. Consumer Safety Commission came out to Madison here and wanted to review all the cases that they had, together with mine. And as a result of that, they mandated that all waterbeds should have a warning label on it, that babies should not be left to sleep on a waterbed. And that still exists. I think all waterbeds have that warning label. Then there was the problem of sheepskin rugs. And the same thing happened with that. It was a next door neighbor who lost a baby on a sheepskin rug.
Mm-hmm.
And the autopsy was done by the coroner at that time. And he called it sudden infant death syndrome. And these parents, who were friends of ours, they were neighbors, came and asked me about it. And I was, when they said the baby had been asleep on a sheepskin rug, I was concerned about it. So we did the same thing with a sheepskin rug. And what happens with the long fibers of the sheepskin, with the baby lying in a prone position and breathing, the moisture of the breathing clogs all those fibers, and it's virtually impossible to breathe through that. And these babies actually suffocate.
Oh dear.
So we also notified the U.S. Consumer Safety Commission, and as far as I know, they have warning signals on sheepskin rugs. But there was a firm here that baby product sold baby products, and I went to talk to them, and they were putting out brochures advising parents to put their babies to sleep on sheepskin rugs, and saying that in Australia that all babies are put to bed on sheepskin rugs. Well, I was horrified, and I told them that I thought these sheepskin rugs were lethal, that these babies were dying on them, but they never would do anything about it. And I don't know whether there was some indication that they may be sued for it, but I don't think that ever happened. But the sheepskin rugs are certainly dangerous, unless the baby is sleeping on its back. But even then, if it's the time when the baby could roll over, you could get a situation that would be lethal to the baby. And then there are rocking cradles that also do the same thing. A rocking cradle can, there are certain types of rocking cradle, one of which was put out by Graco, and they were sued. And there were engineers at MIT that investigated these cradles, because it was my opinion that they were dying on these rocking cradles. So this engineer, a professor at MIT, looked at them from an engineering standpoint, and I went out to Boston and we looked at these and were convinced that they were dangerous. Now those rocking cradles are not made that type that we felt was killing these babies. So I think of all the things I've done, perhaps, not that I've done anything, but I think that these issues of babies that actually suffocate rather than die of some unknown strange cause has been very helpful in reducing the death rate.
That's marvelous. We're going to run out of tape here now, so. Yes.
I do think that many of the babies that heretofore have been called sudden infant death syndrome are actually suffocation deaths. But there is a smaller group which I believe is true sudden infant death syndrome. And these are the babies that I think do have high fetal hemoglobin levels. And we can explain that by hypoxemia or a lack of oxygen that has occurred long before the baby is born in utero. And we do know that women who smoke have a much higher incidence of babies who may die of SIDS. And of course, smoking will create a low oxygen level in the through the placenta and to the baby. And there are other features that are risk factors that do cause hypoxemia. And now there have been neuropathological studies done, particularly by Dr. Hannah Kinney, also a friend of mine at the Boston Children's Hospital, who have documented this by changes in certain areas of the brain that have occurred long before birth of these babies and have predisposed to them having low oxygen and then having a high risk factor for sudden infant death syndrome.
Is there anything to be done for these babies after they're born?
Well, if they're predisposed to hypoxemia, I think the issue now is to prevent the risk factors, particularly women who smoke. Certainly shouldn't smoke during pregnancy, of course, a lot do. And then just to watch them carefully over that critical period, which is 2 to 4 months. Certainly never have them sleep in the prone position. Of course, the incidence now is quite low. It's much less than 1 per 1,000. So it has been greatly reduced just by changing the sleeping position. Mm-hmm.
That's very, very interesting.
Well, Henry Peter was chairman when I first came here. He is just a wonderful person, as well as being a wonderful professor of pathology. He became, after 2 or 3 years when I first came here, he became head of McArdle and was no longer chairman, but maintained his position in the pathology department. I worked very closely in pediatrics, particularly with John Edwards, whom, in my opinion, is probably the greatest medical geneticist in the world. He has described more syndromes and has contributed more to the understanding of genetics than anyone that certainly I know. So this was a great opportunity for me to work with him.
Now, you participated in a lot of university activities as well, committees and...
Yes, I was on various committees of the university. I knew your husband very well, Ben Peckham, who was very famous and was a wonderful person. And I, of course, doing pediatric pathology, I've always had to interact not only with pediatrics but also with obstetrics because I've been interested in the pathology of the embryo and the fetus, and so my interaction has always been strongly oriented to obstetrics as well as pediatrics.
Well, you were on a variety of committees, faculty advisory committee and
right.
review of curriculum and tissue committee.
Right. Well, the tissue committee is interesting because when I first was on the tissue committee, Dr. Karari, who was head of surgery, he was chairman of surgery, asked me would I be the chairman of that committee. And up until that time, it was a meeting that was held at noontime, lunch was provided, and there must have been nearly 50 people on that committee. And I swear they all came to have a good lunch. And I said to him, you know, I think committee meetings are sort of for the birds. It doesn't require many people. And if I do this, all I want is three people on that committee. The head of surgery, the head of OBGYN, the head of pediatrics and pathology. And we can take care of all the tissue problems. So he said, well, that's a wonderful idea. And so I went down in history as the person who really wiped out that committee. Started a small committee. But I remember him at a faculty meeting announcing this and saying, well, Enid Gilbert is the only person here that has her feet on the ground and knows how to run a committee.
Take away the lunch.
Right, right.
Oh, that's wonderful. There were there's just so much that you did here that I feel sort of overwhelmed by it. You were visiting professor in just about every country in the world.
Well, I've been invited to many countries around the world.
Well, but China, South America, Germany, Australia, of course, Tokyo. Were there any of these that particularly were special to you?
Well, it was always special to be invited home mm-hmm. to my country in Australia, and they have invited me on several occasions.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's always nice to go back to your alma mater. I think going to China was very interesting, particularly in the early days when medicine wasn't certainly to be compared with what we see in this country.
Well, you went to Japan any number of times.
Right, yes. Well, that was mostly in research. I had a research an NIH grant while I was here at Wisconsin for almost 20 years. And my research was in the development of the heart and mechanism of how congenital heart defects occur. And I had a laboratory. I had about 3,000 square feet of laboratory space, and I had several postgraduate students, and I also had the people from the Heart Institute in Japan who are actually cardiologists but doing research, and they came to work with me in research. And we developed mechanisms of looking at the heart. We had used chick embryos that were so small that you could only see them under a microscope. And we developed methods of looking at electrocardiograms and the cardiac outflow and or output and all the parameters of the function of the heart, and to see how these were altered and how they could be altered such that cardiac malformations would occur. And so I had a strong relationship with the Heart Institute in Japan, who sent me some of their best researchers in cardiology. So that was really how I was invited several times to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
It was more for the research that I was doing. Yeah. The But these were all areas that I were developed and I did while I was here at Wisconsin, because prior to that time I had really done very little of any substance anyhow. But I think it was the people that I met and encouraged me, and they're really the great faculty that was here at that time, and I'm sure still is. University of Wisconsin is a great university, and I'm very proud to have been here.
Well, certainly the people that you worked with were very enthusiastic about you.
Well, thank you.
You went to South Africa, University of Cape Town. Hong Kong.
Essentially, January 1st, 1993.
You retired from the University of Wisconsin.
Right. But then I took another position.
You took another position.
I hated leaving. It was the saddest day of my life, I think, when I left Madison.
Now, your husband is on the faculty at Tampa as well, is he?
At the University of South Florida. Right.
South Florida.
Right. Mm-hmm. So.
And I noticed that you're a professor in obstetrics and gynecology at that university as well.
I'm always asked about that. Do I practice obstetrics and gynecology? Well, the answer is no, of course. But they interact with me a lot. We have a so-called fetal board there, and every month myself as a pediatric pathologist, geneticist, neonatologists and obstetricians all meet and discuss cases that will be born or have just been born, who may have problems. It's correlated with the ultrasound findings, and it's just a wonderful meeting because we all interact and have our input. And of course, pathology does have a strong input in that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I have just published, it just last week came out, a book on it's embryo and fetal pathology with ultrasound correlation, published by Cambridge University Press. And I think it's, I believe it's the only book of its type that has integrated the whole scenario of embryo and fetal pathology. So my husband says it's the best thing I've ever written, but I don't
know.
Well,
that's nice. Well, among all these other things that you were doing, you've been on the editorial board of publications that I assume come out every
month
or so.
Most of them are monthly publications, right.
That's a fair amount of work all by itself.
Yes, that is a lot of work. But Lou and myself have very few other interests than our work. And people say, well, how have you had time to write as much as I have? But the thing is that that's what we do. Every night and weekend, we're writing or working at what we enjoy doing. And it is our recreation.
Well,
so
that's wonderful.
That's why I dread the thought of having to retire. I know I'm going to have to soon, but I just dread the thought. I'm going to find some voluntary work that I can do. I try to support many children activities. I've been involved with Teen Voices. That's an organization, I don't know whether you know that. That is a organization that supports underprivileged teenage girls who have fallen into bad times, have either been on drugs or become pregnant. And that is an organization that originated in Boston, and one of my children was chairman of that group, and that's how I got involved. But they bought up a floor of a building in Boston, And they have beds there, and they've got computers that have been given to them by various organizations. And I think this is a really worthwhile organization to support. Of course, we support Save the Children, and I'm on the Florida Child Abuse Committee, which is a voluntary thing. And we investigate all the child abuse cases in the state. And also the Death Review Committee, all children and infants who died. We try to investigate those and find out why they have died. And many of them are really very tragic cases.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's quite a different population in Florida.
Oh, yes, it is. Very much different from here.
Mm-hmm.
That is true.
Though our population is changing.
Really?
Here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're getting a lot of
indigent
Mexican families that are having a hard time.
Right.
Don't speak English.
Oh, right. Well, of course, we have a lot of Spanish Hispanics. And there is a lot of work that should be done to support these families.
Now, are you teaching as well?
Yes, I teach. I probably teach as much, if not more, than anyone in the pathology department there. I teach all of the cardiovascular course, and I teach genetic and pediatric pathology. And of course, we have residents, and I teach them. And I have a fellowship program in pediatric pathology, which I think there may be two in the state. Well, I think there's one in Miami, but I have one too. So it's always fun to work with someone who's going to become a pediatric pathologist.
It's not quite fair to compare universities, but
no, there's no comparison with Wisconsin.
It's smaller, is it?
Oh, well, it's smaller. Yes, it's a newer university, newer medical school, but it's doing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm able to do what I like doing, which is the main thing, I guess.
That's wonderful.
But it certainly doesn't have the reputation of Wisconsin.
No. But
no, I'm very proud and very pleased that I had this opportunity here.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, it broke my heart to leave.
No, you're here for, what is this Festschrift? Is that what this meeting is
yes,
that you're here
no,
for?
No, a Festschrift was written for me. A Festschrift is a fest meaning a celebration,
mm-hmm.
Schrift writing.
Oh.
And a Festschrift is done for, well, of course, anybody could have a Festschrift, but somebody has to organize it, and it gets published. And I think it was in 1987 that was published. It was on the occasion of my 60th birthday. And John Opitz organized this, and there was something like over 200 people who had over the years worked with me or had been residents or students with me. And they contributed articles. And the title of that was Topics in Pediatric Genetic Pathology, I think.
Pathology, that's right.
And some very famous people wrote for that. Several people from Wisconsin.
That's a wonderful idea.
And that was published some years ago in a book. It's exactly a book.
And the governor of Wisconsin cited you.
Tommy Thompson.
Right.
He cited my husband too, actually before me.
Did he? Do you work with him at all in health and social services?
No, but I think it was. Oh, I did get something from the Wisconsin SIDS Society. I think they gave me some sort of award. I think that's how it came about, and then he gave me a citation.
But I was wondering if you were working with him.
No.
His current secretary.
Oh, no.
No.
Except that now I can say I got a citation from the from the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who was governor of Wisconsin at the time.
Now, you're involved still with Health and Human Services Committee for Vaccine Injury Prevention?
Oh, yes, that's a national committee, right.
Now, this is, there's quite a bit of writing in the newspaper about vaccine
right.
with babies and whether this is a good idea.
Right.
Or not.
Well, if a baby dies shortly after a vaccination, the parents have the right to appeal, and then the case is investigated to see whether the vaccination really had any played any role in the death of the infant. And that's where I review the autopsy findings and the pathology and review the record. But I think it's extremely rare if it ever does actually occur.
Really?
Right. I think that it's just
other
incidental.
Things.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
It's been other things that have happened.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, these parents are compensated very well. And when they hear that there's a compensation program funded by the federal government,
sure.
You know, they'll appeal for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too bad, I think. But and then just recently I was asked to be on the review committee for the OIM, Institute of Medicine, in IOM.
What's that? The OIM?
So the IOM, Institute of Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
It's a division of the National Academy of Sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been asked to be on their review committee, which is quite prestigious. I was really quite amazed that I was asked to do this. This is just during the last 2 years, but they investigate things to the nth degree when there's some sort of area that they feel should be looked at carefully. And they investigated the immunization program in this country and whether it had any impact on death or untoward reactions in infants. And it was pretty much concluded from that if it does, it must be extremely rare and is probably negligible. So I think the immunization issue really should be a dead issue, but that organization still exists and parents can still appeal.
Well, every once in a while you read paper that...
Yeah, it's just coincidence. They've
mm-hmm.
You know, they've died, or sometimes they'll appeal when the deaths occur a week later. Well, you know, that can't have any influence. Or,
mm-hmm.
But
well, it's so traumatic to
lose
a child
that
they do anything.
It's shocking, right?
Mm-hmm. This is the Hall of Fame
of the
Pathology
Medical School.
Department of the University,
right.
Yale University Medical School.
Right. They asked me to send a picture, and now they've got it hanging on the wall, the Hall of Fame. So, especially my son-in-law went to Yale, so he's very pleased.
Oh, I'm sure.
I've got a recognition from Yale.
I'm not going to go down all of these honors and so forth that you have, because this is going to be filed along with the tape. But I love the one, the 2,000 Outstanding Intellectuals of the 21st Century that
yes.
you're in.
Well, I don't think that means anything. I mean, there's so many of them. I just got a certificate or something.
But you keep right on going. I mean, here you have been appointed a reviewer of the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences. That was just last year.
Well, I guess I've written a fair amount and people see my name. I don't know why.
Well, that's wonderful. You've had a very distinguished
career.
So
well, actually, the highest honor I've ever gotten, I just got this year, and that is the Order of Australia. You probably don't know what that is.
I have heard of it.
There's an Order of Canada, it's similar to that. And it's similar to the United Kingdom a knighthood.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I was, I don't know who, the person who nominated me was the Chancellor of Sydney University, who gave me an honorary degree in 1999. And she has been, I guess, knighted. She's Dame Leonie Cramer. So she recommended me, and there were 10 letters of recommendation from very famous people. And it went to England. And it was approved by the Queen. So I was all set to become a dame. But then they looked at it again, and they said, well, I was born in Australia, and I still have Australian citizenship as well as American citizenship. So they thought it was more appropriate that Australia give me the honour. So that was announced on Australia Day, which was the 26th of January of this year. And I'm going to Australia just in about 10 days' time for the investiture.
Oh, wonderful.
So I'm not going to be a dame.
That's a tremendous honour over
well,
there.
Well, that is very nice. But
an old friend of ours, Brian Hudson,
oh, really?
Got that honour.
Oh, really?
He was an endocrinologist in Melbourne.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well,
and he was thrilled.
Yes, well, it is. I think it's very nice.
It is. It's just wonderful.
I tell my children that I got an honorary, two honorary degrees, one from here and one from the University of Sydney, my alma mater. And I think to get an honorary degree is, I was thrilled. And my children, I mean, they say, oh, but an AO, that's much better. I don't think it is, but... Anyhow.
Are they going with you?
They are all going.
Are
I think
they
20
really?
Of the family are going.
Oh, how marvelous. You
should take
that's
out stock
wonderful.
In the Qantas Airlines, I think.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, you'll have a wonderful time.
Oh, it will be nice. Mr. Wisconsin Medical Alumni Distinguished Teaching. Oh, no, that. And the
yes, I noticed you were nominated just about every year you were here.
Oh, as a teaching award, but then it was the I got that
Distinguished Teaching Award in 1981.
Yes, but then Distinguished Medical Alumni Professorship, that was in 86. I think they stopped doing that. I think I was the first. And then following that in the following two or three years, that was given, but I don't think it's given anymore.
I don't know.
This Distinguished Medical Alumni Professor, University of Wisconsin. See, I did almost everything I've done was here at the University of Wisconsin.
Well, I don't know. It seems to me you've done a lot outside of Wisconsin as well.
I don't know how many years I'd been here, maybe 10 or 12 years. They were looking for a chairman. The chairmanship of pathology has been very rocky. Henry Peto was fabulous, but he became director of McArdle, and then they had interim chairman. And Stan Inhorn became chairman, and he was good, but he had enough of it after two or three years. And I can well understand that, but... Henry Peto became acting dean, and he asked me would I consider being chairman of pathology. Well, that's a big job, and I'm not cut out for that sort of thing. I told him, you know, I enjoy what I do, I enjoy the work, but I would be a terrible chairman, and I know I would. And he tried to twist my arm. He said, oh, he'd give me a business manager and, you know, everything I wanted to be. I said, Henry, I'm sorry, but I'm just not cut out for that. So, but it was an honor to me that he even thought of asking.
What is teratology?
Teratology is the science of really malformations of drugs or chemicals or anything that may cause a malformation,
mm-hmm.
is called a teratogen. So So teratology is the study of malformations that have occurred due to some environmental factor, drugs, chemicals, and so forth.
And you're still a reviewer?
I review, but I'm not on there. I'm not on that committee anymore. I've given up a few things in my old age.
Not very many, I think.
I've actually just started a new journal. It will be called Fetal and Pediatric Pathology. And I agreed to do it for a short period of time just to get it launched, because I think I am getting to the age where I'm going to have to give a lot of these things up.
You certainly don't look it. Dr. Enid Gilbert Barnes, and we're talking about a book that she has just written.
I have just published a book which is called Silent Injustice, and it's the stories of four women who were unjustly accused of homicide, killing their babies. And I have testified in several high-profile cases in this country where babies have died and where the mother has usually been accused of homicide. And, for instance, I was asked to testify in the Nanny case and in the Delaware case, and, in fact, many of the big high-profile cases. And many I have refused because I feel I could not defend them, that they actually did, you know, throw the baby into the garbage can or whatever. But there are a certain number of these poor girls that have not done anything, but I seem to be automatically accused as soon as they find that the baby has died. So I chose four cases in which I have testified which I thought were most compelling. And the first case, and I'm not going to go into all of them, but the first case was an English girl who had lost her very best friend, who was only in her 20s, from breast cancer. And she was devastated, and she had a boyfriend who also knew this friend of hers, and they decided that they would come to New York just to get away from it all, from England, and they brought his two brothers, so there were three boys and this girl. She was pregnant, but she had not told anybody. She had not told the boy who got her pregnant. And the night before they were to leave New York and to go back to England, she delivered the baby in a hotel, which was in a seedy area of New York in Soho. And she knew that she was going into labor because she felt labor pains, and she told the boy, since it was their last night, to go out and have a good time. She wasn't feeling well, and she actually delivered this baby in a hotel room, and without any anesthesia or anything else, she passed out. She bled a lot, and when she sort of came to, she found that the baby was not breathing. And she cleaned up all the mess and put the baby into a plastic bag. And then when they went to the airport the next day, she put it under her overcoat. And they went to Kennedy Airport. And one of the security officers, as they were going to go through the security, before she actually went through the security, she had this baby in her overcoat. Picked her out because she thought there was something about her demeanor that was different, and took her aside. And they looked at him under a coat and in the bag, and they saw a baby. So they put her into a room, they chained her down. The treatment that she had was unbelievable. She was severely lacerated. The boys were questioned, but they said they had no knowledge of it, so they missed their plane but got the next one. She was held here, and she was put into Rikers Jail, which is the highest security jail for women in this country, Rikers Island in New York, and she was there for 8 months. And she was treated abominably. The conditions were unbelievable. She came from a very upper middle class family, lovely family, whom I've met. And she was just treated unbelievably. But, you know, she was put in a bullpen and taken frequently to the court and interrogated and just terrible way. I mean, I had no idea how these women could be treated. A lovely girl. And a sister who was a social worker at the jail became very friendly with her, Sister Marion, and she gave her a diary, and she asked her to keep the diary, and she assured her that happier days would come. And she kept this diary, and when it was time for her trial, I was asked if I would look at the case and testify on her behalf, and I agreed to do so. And a very famous pediatric pathology from England, Professor John Emery, had looked at it, but he didn't tell me what he found. And he had recommended that I look at it, because it was a British and a German pathologist, and they wanted someone in this country. So I said I would, and there was absolutely no doubt in my mind, and when I looked at the pathology of this baby, that it had to be stillborn. You know, it was just the appearance of the lungs and other features that I was quite sure that the baby had been dead when it was born, or died during delivery. So anyhow, I testified to that, and I wrote a report and gave my report to the judge, and the attorney for this girl this girl was so downtrodden and so emotionally upset and affected by all this, that they were afraid that if she went to court for a jury, that she wouldn't hold up in court and she'd be accused of murder, and then she may spend the rest of her life in jail. So they persuaded her to plea bargain. This is something that's done in this country, which I strongly object to. And all these four cases that I have written about had to plea bargain, or they did plea bargain, because in plea bargaining they are assured of a lesser sentence. And this girl, in a very soft whisper in the courtroom, said that she had killed the baby, and she hadn't. Then she was released on. She had to stay in a foster home for another 6 months in this country. Meantime, the consulate the British consulate had been involved. Her parents had been over, and all sorts of British. And it had been on 60 Minutes, on 2020. In the British newspapers, in the London Times, it was all over the newspapers in this country and in England. And finally she was released, and she, on my testimony, she was released. She went back to England. She had to have psychiatric treatment for 3 years, and we visited her. I had a meeting in Cambridge in England. So we went and visited the family, visited her, and she is a lovely girl. And I've got pictures of her as a little girl, and when she was in prison, she looked awful, and now when we met her 2 or 3 years later. And but the irony of the whole story is that after this was all over, somebody found pictures that were taken at the time of autopsy of this baby, and they sent them to me, and they said, well, you know, they hadn't been divulged at the time, but the umbilical cord, and you would know this from Ben being in that area, was twisted like a corkscrew and thrombosed. There was no way that blood could go through to the placenta. That baby had to be stillborn, even though I had I think pretty much confirmed that it was stillborn from the tissues, the lungs and so forth. But this was absolute unequivocal evidence that this baby was stillborn. When I saw this, I called her parents and I said, look, this is, and in the meantime, I had written to the New York Times, and the letter was published. And it was, I wrote to the London Times and they published my letter, verifying my opinion. But that didn't make any difference. She'd already spent her time in jail and she had plea bargained. So when I found this twisted cord like a corkscrew, I talked to her parents and I said, you know, I want to write a letter to the London Times and clear this forever. And they said, well, they'd like me to, but I should talk to Caroline. So I got hold of Caroline and I said, look, you know, I know I don't want to bring it up again. I know it's behind you now, but I would like to do this to vindicate you forever. And she thought about it and she called me back and she said, you know, I don't want you to do that. She said, it's all over now. I don't want it brought up again.
Where were these pictures all this time?
In New York, in the coroner's office.
In the coroner's office?
In Queens.
And they didn't produce them for the trial?
No, they didn't produce them. They said that they were lost. They didn't know they existed. And then the lawyer who was acting on her behalf got them and sent them to me. And asked, you know, he didn't think anything of it. He said, oh, you might like it. It's over now, but do you want to see the picture of the baby? And this baby was buried in Potter's Field. You know what Potter's Field
is? Yes.
Right. It's for paupers. And it was named for Christ and for Julius Iscariot. Threw down his the silver. And
I didn't know that story, but I know that it's for the homeless.
Well, that was how
indeed,
it was
yes.
named Potter's Field. Well, they... I guess they couldn't find where the baby was born, where the baby was buried. And Caroline wanted that baby. She wanted to take it back to England and bury it. And finally they did find the body. And the priest, she was not Catholic. She was Church of England, Anglican. But Catholic priest was so good to her. I think she's become Catholic now. She was so impressed with him.
Mm.
He took Father Tony, he took the body over to her.
My goodness.
And buried it in England.
You don't like to think that things like that happen in our courts.
Just awful. Oh, I can tell you any number of cases like this. And this book is, I've related four stories, that's one of them. But, you know, I think they're all tragic.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first, the whole issue of teenage pregnancy, I think is a terrible... a tragedy in this country. And one of the chapters in the book, actually, the Seegers have a copy. I gave them a copy. But if you're interested, I'd be very happy to read it.
I would like to.
But it's...
And
I've written a whole chapter on what I believe is the issue of teenage pregnancy.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to read
and
that.
There has to be some solution for this. It really does. That's written for the lay person. It's not. It is medically oriented, I guess, because of
who's publishing this.
It's Custom Editorial Productions, and Barnes and Noble's have it. They've sold a few copies, but it hasn't been well advertised, so there haven't been many copies sold. But. And I did do a book signing in Sarasota a few months ago.
Well, it sounds like a book that a lot of people who are interested young people today are.
Well, I would think so, but I suppose it's. Well, all of these girls, it all turned out all right because they all, you know, got out of, you know, the homicide verdict. And, you know, I essentially was responsible for getting them out of jail, and getting out and leading a hopefully normal life. But, you know, this affects these young girls.
Of course it does.
Just And I've kept in touch with all of them.
And they're
fine. And I do this pro bono. I don't charge anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother of one of these girls in New York was so grateful, and she sent me a check for $1,000. And she'd had to mortgage it. She had to mortgage everything she had to get some, you know, legal help for a girl, for her daughter. And, you know, I was so touched by that. It was such a lovely note. I tore the check up. I said, I can't accept this. But they are, at least it touched my heart, those cases. And I felt compelled that I had to write it.
Well, I'd like very much to read it.
And actually, the foreword in that book was written by a Pulitzer Prize winner who happens to be a friend of ours.
Mm.
He was editor of the Washington Post and was a war correspondent during the Second World War. And he's very well known, Gene Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very touched by the book, and he's written a beautiful foreword. It really does. Touch the whole thing off.
That's nice.
So that was my first effort in writing, not purely medical writing. But now I've started to write a book about Australia, about the origin of Australia and the first settlements and the Aboriginals and my childhood and my living there. I think it'll interest my family more than anyone else, but at least
it's a fascinating place.
Right, it is a fascinating place.
It really
place.
Is.
Right.
It's a fascinating country.
Right, it is.
Full of marvelous people that are happy.
Right, they are. Australians are happy.
Chronically happy.
Right, and they're very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can walk down a street in Sydney or Melbourne or anywhere in Australia and you've lost your way and you ask someone, you know, where is so-and-so street? They don't tell you, they take you. You know, and I'd forgotten that, having lived here for so long.
Yes.
I'd forgotten, but Australians are. They're very generous, they're happy, they're different. Breed in many ways.
Mm-hmm. The only problem with Australia is it's so far away.
It's so far away, right. But, you know, I used to go back every year, and now I still go back every couple of years, and of course I'll be going back soon. But my children all love Australia. They've all been several times. And in fact, the daughter that just got married about a little over a year ago now married an Australian boy.
For goodness sake.
And I had nothing to do with it.
Well, Enid, this was very, very interesting, and I'm awfully glad that we were able to connect while you were up here.
Yes, that's wonderful. It really
do you want to tell what this meeting is that you're here for, that you
well,
and your
this
husband
is
are
a, it's an annual meeting that's given as grand rounds. It's called the Gilbert Barnes Lecture. And as I mentioned, my husband gave the first one, I gave the second one, but now some nationally recognized person comes to give, and it's at Grand Rounds.
Mm-hmm.
And
in the Department of Pediatrics or
both.
Pathology?
1 year it's pediatrics and the next year it's pathology. This year it's pathology.
Mm-hmm.
So it's usually a pediatric pathologist who comes for pathology and some well-known pediatrician who gives the like last year it was given by the dean, Phil Fowler, for pediatrics.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good occasion.
And
it's
you
a good excuse to come back to Wisconsin.
You and your husband endowed this lecture.
Yeah, he did.
He did.
Mm-hmm. So it gives us the opportunity to come home.
Wonderful.
Again.
Good excuse.
I still call Madison home. I don't know why, but I do.
Well, 23 years.
Yes, and my children all grew up here.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, it's
any of them here?
No, they're not. They have all left. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They all went to school out east.
Mm-hmm.
And two of them went into medicine.
Oh, that's
right. And couple went to Harvard Business School, and financially they're doing a lot better than anyone else.
Of course. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you and hearing all this, and we thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking with you, and as I mentioned, I was a great admirer of your husband.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.